I probably get to sit face to face with Jonathan Swartz from ASU. I was reading your thesis was on studying the treatises of other historical violinists, then adding your own to how do we play this instrument based on these things. And now you're here teaching all that inspired information to kids. How did you get here?
I actually had never been to Arizona before ASU invited me out to interview for the position. Coming from Toronto, this is very far away for me. But I have to say it agrees with me very much. The environment here in Arizona and the university and what the university is working towards, this is a place for opportunity. You build your career in Boston or New York, and there are so many traditions of the way things have been done. Sometimes it's hard to make an impact and to do something a little bit different. And here in Arizona, I think it's possible. And our quartet program is a perfect example of forging a new path. And in many ways, it's become a model that other schools have been following for how to devise a chamber music program. And it started here. And I don't know that that would have been able to take off in one of those other traditional musical centers. So the opportunity is just incredible here.
When did you decide what you really wanted to do? Because you perform. We're going to be talking about a performance you've got coming up November 23rd with your wife.
Mm-hmm.
When did you decide, though, in addition to playing, I want to teach? I want to share what I've learned.
I think it's always been a part of me from the time I was a little kid. And I remember what I learned playing baseball and wanting to teach my brother how to throw the ball correctly. There's just something in my personality that whatever process I've been through and whatever I've had to figure out for myself and the help that I've had to figure it out, there's been a part of me that's wanted to help someone else get there easier than I did. So there must be just something in the personality. And because I've been invested in studying violin since the time I was 4 years old, and it has so many challenges that I continue to tackle today, that it's a never-ending process of learning, not just for myself how to play and to do things that I want to do musically, but also new perspectives on how to teach and how to help other people. And it's just something that I've always assumed would be a part of my life.
And sometimes it comes down to who plays what best. There are those people who can play anything. When I was a kid playing the violin, Grumio's Bach was my Bach, right? If you're going to listen to Mozart, it was Francescatti. That was my Mozart. And yet when you're a performing artist, we'll be hearing you play some pretty disparate composers. We've got Ludoslavsky.
Yes.
Bach in the middle and Respighi.
Yes.
And I should start here, actually. What is it with you guys that you people at ASU marrying pianists, Katie McLennan and everything? You and Wendy Chen, I was reading your bio and it says so beautifully that your favorite collaborators, off-time collaborators, your sister, who's principal harp with Montreal.
Yes.
And, of course, Wendy Chen, your wife.
Yes.
And how did you guys meet, you and Wendy? I know you met your sister.
Wendy and I actually met in El Paso, the melting pot of all places. I was teaching before I came to ASU. I was teaching at the University of Texas, El Paso, for a year. And they had an incredible chamber music festival during the winter where they would invite these wonderful musicians out for 2 weeks to be in residence and play concerts almost every night. And being in El Paso and being friends with the director of that festival, I was invited to participate in the festival. And Wendy was one of the pianists that they brought out. And so that's where we met. I have to say that she didn't like me immediately. But it changed after I was asked to turn pages for her in one concert. And I'll never turn pages again because I'll never be able to live up to how well I did at that time. But something shifted after I assisted in page turning. After the festival, we kept in touch for about 4 months of a long distance relationship of getting to know each other and then got together. And the rest is pretty much history.
Do you remember what the first things you played were?
It's funny, Wendy and I did not perform together a lot in the early stages of our relationship. In fact, I have to say we didn't even talk about music that much. There was just so much else that was of interest to both of us in our lives. And Wendy had her career as this concertizing pianist, and I was building my career as a university professor and performing. And they seemed to be separate paths. And it's only more recently that we've been performing more together, we've made recording together, and we found opportunities to collaborate.
You mentioned Gil Shaham, again, one of my favorite fiddle players. Mm-hmm. And when I talked to him about that bizarre bond that happens familially, and actually it was a year where both he and Orly were in town, not together. They played on the symphonies one season. Independent concerts, and they each had the same kind of answer. It's as though we can read each other's minds. It's kind of freaky, is the way they put it. And there are those families, and you think of Schubert writing music for his family to play in their home and all the history of... But when you marry someone, when you choose, this is... You get to do that once, maybe more if you're less than lucky, but you get to do that one time, and this is someone you make journeys with and all kinds of things, and when it's music, what's that like for you guys?
It's music, as you know, is like another language. And so in many ways, it's another way of getting to hear what someone thinks, hear how someone communicates, hear what someone has to offer. And for me, it's much deeper than that because I'm so interested in the process. And so when I get to know how someone works, how someone prepares for a concert, how they... their process for learning music. It's very interesting to me and gives me a great window and insight into that person and their personality. And I have to say regarding Wendy, she works so differently than I do. And so it's just fascinating to me. She has an incredible efficiency about her. She's able to get done in less time more than anyone that I know, and at the highest level. And I think of myself a little bit more workmanlike. I get in the trenches, and I'm not working at the elite level or of daily artistry that she is. And so it's very fascinating to me. And in many ways, that also may be why our performing careers have been on different paths. And I try to learn from everyone, and I try to absorb whatever I can from her process. And I will still always be my methodical workman-like self, but I do try to embrace and learn from her. And I think over the years of being together and over the years of performing together, I have to thank her because I think that my process has improved and I think my violin playing has improved by being with her.
Just as you described is why you're the teacher that I understand you are. To be able to hear how someone works. How does your mind operate? How do you learn? Because we don't all learn the same way. So if you've got a studio full of fiddle players and you're trying to make them think the way you do, everybody's time is kind of frustrating, right? That's absolutely, that's a great story. This concert, you mentioned there was to be a piece on this that you would not want to talk about that.
Oh, that's fine. Absolutely.
There was to be a piece on this by a friend of yours from Canada, a composer that you featured on a couple of recordings, and something happened here. It didn't quite make the program.
Well, I've been thinking a lot about this and how difficult it is for composers today. Maybe it's always been difficult for composers, but, you know, there are very few composers today that can have composition be their sole profession. It's difficult. They don't have the backers that composers had, the supporters that composers had in the past, or the positions where you would be put in and asked just to compose music. And so often we have our composers of today are doing double and triple duty. They're holding on a computer job and composing on the side, or they're piecing together directing musicals and conducting, you know, one thing or the other, and playing organ in the church and somehow trying to find some time to compose. And so I'm very sympathetic to that process. And as much as I want to be encouraging these new compositions as quickly as possible, I also want to make sure that the composer is really doing what they want and that the end result reflects their greatest effort. And if that means that there are some delays and some bumps in the road, I just deal with that. And this composer, Kieran McMillan, who's a friend of mine, I feel very strongly that he's such a talented composer, and I feel a responsibility as a performer to be playing works from our time and to be helping support these composers. And so I have had an extended commissioning project with him that, as you referred to, has already generated three compositions that we've premiered and recorded. And the fourth commission was supposed to be premiered on this concert with Wendy, and it's a piece that's written for the two of us. And unfortunately, it didn't get done in time. But it will be, and we will do a performance of it when it's done, and I'll just be patient for that to happen. As far as our program that I conceived of with the Ludoslavsky and this new work by Kieran McMillan and the Respighi Sonata, I was very intrigued about putting these works together. The Ludoslavsky, Ludoslavsky is an incredible composer, and I think many people know of his compositions. But what makes an incredible composition that people can relate to in our time? I'm always intrigued by that. I think there's something to do with gesture. I think there's something to do with lyricism. I think there has to be a compelling voice and a technique that listeners can resonate with immediately. There has to be a hook. It can't be so cerebral that on first hearing, a listener can't get it. And the Ludoslavsky Subito, which we are still going to begin our program with, is one of these works. It's shocking at times. It's lyrical at times. There's a rhythmic intensity at times that I think is wonderfully gripping. And it's a very efficient work. It's under 5 minutes of music. And I thought, what better way to introduce this program than with this work, Subito, suddenly. Then I thought having Kieran's new work would be the perfect complement to that and the perfect opportunity to introduce that. And then on the end of the program, Respighi's B minor sonata, which I think is one of the great sonatas for violin and piano, but also one of the underplayed sonatas for violin and piano. And I thought, what better way to present a new composer alongside these other compositions that also need a little bit more recognition. Without Kieran's piece, the only thing I could think to do is to substitute Johann Sebastian Bach and really put Bach in the light of what makes Bach such an incredible composer. I think we all just assume Bach's genius, and we've heard so much of the music, and it's just assumed, but we don't always take a moment to reflect upon, well, what is it that makes Bach's composition so incredible? And the sonata that I've chosen, the unaccompanied A minor violin sonata, I think is a perfect example of what makes Bach such a genius. The first movement is in a form that if it were written 100 years later, Bach would have been considered having written one of the best examples of this form of music. But Bach doesn't even get any credit for it because, according to our music history books, this form wasn't even developed until 20 or 30 years later. It's just absolutely amazing to me. And the form I'm referring to is sonata form, which of course became predominant in the classical period and into the romantic period. But this is a perfect example. This I look at as a precursor to sonata form. And if it were written 100 years later, I think Bach would have been championed as the greatest version of sonata form ever to exist. And then it follows with a fugue. And of course, back in the day, a fugue was how composers were measured, how well you could write a fugue. And this is what made Bach stand above everyone else, was his ability to write a fugue. And to write a fugue for the violin, which is essentially an instrument that plays one line at a time, it's a single line instrument. And you write a fugue which has many voices, many lines having to occur simultaneously, is a feat in itself. So any fugue would be incredible. anything for unaccompanied violin would be incredible. But to do a fugue for unaccompanied violin and to do it as masterfully as Bach is truly a genius. The third movement of Bach's work is one of his more lyrical movements, and it has its challenges too, as it's essentially written for two violins and you have to play it on one. You are both the melody and the accompaniment and the harmony all together. And then the final movement of the sonata is probably one of Bach's more fiddling movements. It has dance elements. It's like a fiddling allemande, if you will. And it's one of his wilder virtuosic movements. And when I think about the sonata as a whole, and I think about Bach as a composer and when he wrote this in his life, it's such a fascinating example and a perfect substitute for Kieran McMillan's work. Bach wrote this at a time when he wrote basically all of his secular music. The rest of his life, he was always hired to be writing music for the church. And this was his one opportunity to write music that wasn't specifically intended for the church. And so it speaks a little bit to the opportunity and how composers have to juggle what it is that they write and when they're able to write. And so I couldn't think of a more perfect substitute for Kieran's piece. And really, we just say that Kieran's piece is on hold and it will be played in not too distant future.
When you speak to keyboard players about Mozart or Brahms and the way they wrote for their instrument, those players have a real sense of what kind of pianist this guy must have been. Do you have a sense of what Bach thought of or how he played the violin from this sonata?
Based on his compositions for violin, Bach must have been a very accomplished violinist. This music is not easy. And what I described to you about playing the fugue and the feat of getting your hands around this and doing so many things at one time, it's just incredible. And stories are that Bach was able to play his sonatas and partitas. And so by all accounts, he must have been a very accomplished violinist.
Did he, because there are keyboard, well, if you're a composer, you're supposed to be able to write for anything. If you don't play the harmonica, I don't care. I want a harmonica concerto. So you just have to find out the range and what I... But when you're Rachmaninoff and you're writing something that's really tough and your hands are, you know, umpteen feet long, you give the other pianist a way out. On some of these things, really tricky things for any instrument, quite often, not with Brahms because everything's just hard, but other instruments, when things get tough, the composer who knew the instrument either put it in a key or did a thing that was just, okay, it's going to sound really hard to do, and it is hard to do, but I'm going to make it easy on you because I put it here. Are those tricks there for Bach in this?
Absolutely, it's idiomatic, but it's not easy. So I don't know that he compromised his compositional intent just to make it possible to play on the violin. And if you look at other unaccompanied violin works around Bach's time, they aren't as artfully crafted, both technically on the instrument and musically. And it's not to say that they're easier or more difficult technically, but just what we call being idiomatic, something that just fits well with the instrument. Bach really found an incredible balance between being so rich compositionally, being incredibly challenging technically, but being absolutely possible and idiomatic on the instrument. And having played other unaccompanied works from that time period, this is again what makes Bach stand out among the other composers as one of the greatest.
When we talk about Respighi, this is a man who died in the 1930s, right around 1936 or something, who for a time in his life took up the trends, you know, right with what's this 12-tone stuff and how do we do these? And then decided, no, we haven't done enough of this melodic invention. In fact, I had a friend who once said that Respighi was a 20th century composer who had a villa in 18th century. Tell me about him and this sonata. We think of Respighi, usually it's with the pines of Rome, the fountains of Rome, the ancient airs and dances suites, those really tuneful little bits that never let you down. They just keep you all the way through. What's this like?
Interestingly, this sonata was also composed, it was around the same time period as the works you just referred to. And we don't think of Respighi really in terms of a chamber music composer, and certainly as a sonata composer. But interestingly, Respighi played both violin and piano. He also played the viola. I'm amazed. He must have been a tremendous piano player. He gave the premier performance. He was the pianist in the premier performance of this sonata. And one of the reasons I think the sonata is not heard that often is because of how challenging the piano part is. Mm. It happens to be one of Wendy's favorite pieces, and so it was incentive for me to program it. And it is really an incredible composition. Respighi has elements of deep romanticism. There's elements of impressionism. It's very much in the aesthetic of the early 20th century, where the sense of rubato and manipulation of tempo and meter in almost a seamless fashion is integrated into his writing. In a very intricate way, very different than the symphonic works that he wrote. And so, as I mentioned before, I do believe that this piece doesn't get the recognition that it deserves. It's up there with the great violin sonatas of Brahms and Fauré and Franck. There are elements of Korngold that I hear in there. I sometimes wonder about Korngold, Mahler, and Respighi and what was going on in terms of their compositional notation and how they were able to evoke this incredible sense of meter and rhythmic transformation that would make their music otherworldly. It really feels at times that you don't put your foot down, but the music keeps sweeping you away to some other place you couldn't have imagined. And there's something in the writing, there's something in the rhythm and meter that these composers are using that makes their music so special to me.
I'd never put the names in the same sentence before. That's absolutely, I'm gonna have to go back and listen now. I knew. The language we use to describe pieces of music, or what the composer puts on the piece of music, very often are more powerful than the audience says. The Beethoven Sonata for Violin and Piano. Could also be the Beethoven Sonata for Piano and Violin. They're partners.
Well, that's true, and I think most of them are listed as Beethoven Sonata for Piano and Violin.
With Respighi, what you just told me, I'm trying to remember now, what's on the score?
This is with violin and piano. Yeah. I think after the classical period, I have to now check in the recesses of my memory if there are any pieces that are indicated as sonatas for piano and violin. That's something the way sonata started, is that there were piano sonatas with violin. That's Mozart, that's Beethoven. I'm hard-pressed at the moment to think of a composition later than that was indicated for piano with violin. They're usually for violin and piano.
But the language in this case, it's really, well, you mentioned other Fauré, Franck, mm-hmm. Brahms, other sonatas, it really is a partnership. You couldn't, the parts have equal weight, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Absolutely, and I think more than how the composers describe them, I would absolutely agree if the point you're trying to make is that they're piano sonatas first and foremost, in terms of the significance of the piano part and the way that the piano develops the musical material. They are absolute partnerships, but I believe wholeheartedly that the success of our performance is so much dependent on Wendy on the piano, more dependent on that than me as a violinist. I think sometimes when people go and hear concerts and they hear violin and piano playing together, some people associate the piano in an accompanying role, that I'm here to hear the violin play this melody and the piano is supporting it and making it more beautiful. These sonatas are not like that at all, and very much I would suggest putting the piano first and foremost and realize how the violin is intertwined with that rather than thinking it of the violin, because the violinist is standing up there in front of the piano as being the primary role.
Mm-hmm. Well, just the idea that Wendy wants to, you know, it's one of her favorite pieces, that says volumes about what this must be.
Yes, so, absolutely.
And a great opportunity for partners in music and partners in life to get a chance to play something that we don't often get a chance to hear. So thank you for that.
Pleasure.
And Jonathan Swartz, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.